And stay tuned for the Surreal News, which is coming up next on WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station. All right, you're listening to the Surreal News on WSLR. Thanks for tuning in. We have a packed show today, and in the studio we have a few co-hosts. We have Andrea and Joan, and we also have Justin sitting in with us this morning too. All right, Andrea, we have some underwriting.
We do. We are brought to you and programming at WSLR by listeners like you and a company called NewView, who for 15 years has provided Sarasota residents with a variety of services, from property management to house cleaning to window washing. Homegrown with a local perspective, you can contact NewView at 955-4060, or you could get them on their site at newviewinc.com.
All right, well done. We have a packed show coming up this morning. We're going to go to Honduras and talk to somebody from the Peace Corps. That's Barbara Joe, who's an award-winning writer. And then we're going to do Hands Across the Sand with Pete Gross, who organized a local event here, which was last weekend. We also have our Tannen Weekly, a great one today, and then our Media Matters Minutes. Let's start with some news items, and who's ready for our first news item here? Joan, you got one for us?
I have one. You know me. I'm always following the courts and what's going on. But here's a kind of a good news for those of us who favor the health care improvement laws. The ACA, which... the Affordable Care Act. This is what I call a middle court decision out of the Sixth Circuit, which is Kentucky, Michigan, Ohio, and Tennessee. This was a decision on the issue of, can the government require people to buy their own health insurance? It was, of course, highly debated whether the government could do that, whether it was part of the regulation of interstate commerce, because while the government has been able to keep people from doing things, it's never been able to make them do things. What's really interesting about this case is that it was a 2-1 decision, but one of the two judges saying it's okay and approving this act is known as a very extremely conservative judge, Judge Jeffrey Sutton, who was appointed by President George W. Bush. And he very carefully laid out the arguments on both sides, why the government could require this, and the arguments for why it couldn't, came in favor. Now, this is the last court before this case then can go to the Supreme Court. Chances are they're going to wait until there's a collection of cases, because this is being contested in several areas. But it's a very positive decision for the Obama administration and the Affordable Care Act, because it says you can do it. And this is an extremely conservative judge laying out the arguments very carefully.
Very good. We appreciate that reporting, Joan, about some legal things going on in the news.
Wow, hang on to your hats. Ohio is going to allow guns in bars. It sounds like the Old West is making a revival in Ohio. Governor John Kasich signed a law on Thursday that allows gun owners to bring concealed weapons into bars. And everywhere else, alcohol is served. But the law prevents a person from drinking or doing drugs when they carry a gun into a bar. I don't know how that's supposed to work. And that's not all. The law allows licensed gun owners to carry a loaded gun in a car without securing it, and they can also remove it from a secure location while driving. Individual businesses can still opt to ban guns from their venues. The Cincinnati Bengals football team has said that they will not allow guests to bring concealed weapons into the stadium. That's progress.
More guns there. All right, I want to switch gears. This is such a surreal news item. Cyril Colbert. Answers on campaign finances. And Steve Colbert, who is on the Comedy Channel, the Colbert Report, wanted to launch a Colbert Super PAC, a political action committee that would allow him to raise unlimited funds of money from corporations, unions, and individuals to support or oppose candidates in the 2012 elections through independent expenditures such as TV ads like his show. And indeed, the Colbert asked the commission yesterday to make an exemption to allow him to use the show's airtime, staff, and other resources for his political action committee without having to publicly disclose in-kind contributions from Comedy Central's parent company, Viacom. And indeed, that was approved yesterday by the commission, did give him approval for the super PAC. Comments, folks, in the studio? We have Steve Colbert with a super PAC. This is such a surreal news item here.
Well, this is wonderful because we don't have any idea what he's going to do with the money that he collects. We can guess, those of us who are fans of his and know what his leanings are in spite of the persona that he wears on TV. We can guess, and he will have all the power of the, I believe, of the super PACs that the Koch brothers, for example, are contributing to. Whether he can get that much money, I don't know. The fears, of course, are that this will open the floodgates, so to speak, for all sorts of wealthy groups to put on whatever kind of advertising they want to in a campaign and with minimal responsibility. So we really have to see where it goes.
Yes, and one of the things he put in asking for this exemption from the FEC was the following. Let's see, the PAC may also pay usual and normal administrative expenses, all right, such as, including but not limited to luxury hotel stays, private jet travel, PAC mementos from Saks Fifth Avenue, and Neiman Marcus, according to the lawyers.
You know, in a weird kind of way, this blows things so wide open that it might really be a circus where now we can see what goes on behind the scenes. I mean, it's really making things a lot more transparent and showing how broken our system is.
I think that's what his motivation is. I think he's said as much.
Yeah.
And that's great. It's incredible the power, positive power, that some of the comedians who are really, really smart have come up with.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. I just want to report briefly that Minnesota government has shut down. As of midnight last night, a budget deal was unreached, and that was a fight between the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor, Governor Mark Dayton, and Republican legislative leaders last night. They were divided on how much the state should spend over the next 2 years, and there was no agreement reached, and we have a shutdown now in Minnesota. And who has another news item?
Well, I have a little more court news because I just can't lay off the court news. This is kind of an interesting one about strange bedfellows. This was a case in California, Brown versus Entertainment Merchants Association. This was about a California law that restricts the sale or rental of violent video games to minors. And this was found by each court to be unconstitutional because it abridges the First Amendment right of not only freedom of speech to minors and freedom of access by minors. The strange bedfellows, this was a 7-2 decision, and the two dissenting judges who thought the law was okay, who thought you could restrict the sale or leasing of these violent materials, were Justice Clarence Thomas, who we know is an ultra conservative and an originalist, as they call him, and Justice Stephen Breyer, who we know generally as a very left-leaning justice. So that was all very strange. But only they said that these violent videos can be purchased or leased to minors. However, we still have some restrictions on videos, video games, this is, that portray sexuality. One of the big issues is that this now gives the okay to video games as part of our literature, if you will. They've moved into that area along with movies, books, stories, and now we have video games as part of that.
Yeah, multimedia. I wonder when texting and things like Twittering will also move into as our society has changed. I want to go out to Kansas for a second for women's rights, and that Kansas abortion clinics were facing a shutdown, except that there was a lawsuit that blocked that by Planned Parenthood. And this comes out of a huge area of the United States around Kansas that was threatened to not have any abortion rights. So a new law in Kansas imposed strict requirements for abortion clinic facilities that made it nearly impossible for the state's three abortion clinics to stay in operation. One clinic was already denied a license, and they were heading towards a showdown where none of the clinics were going to get approval. For example, some of the new clinic requirements, which were more stringent than hospitals for exactly the same procedure, that is a procedure done in the hospital versus an abortion clinic or in a doctor's office, totally different regulations. The temperature had to be between 68 and 73 degrees, have a janitor's closet of at least 50 square feet and an operating room of 150 square feet, separate dressing rooms for staff and patients, 13 different types of drugs on hand, patients required to stay in the recovery room for 2 hours, even though for exactly the same procedure in other situations, 15 minutes. So really, these were rules that were delivered on Monday, and by Wednesday they had inspectors coming out to shut down the clinics. In other words, made it impossible. One of the clinics was able to, that was one of the Planned Parenthood clinics, was able to comply, so they delivered more regulations, and these had to do only with building code. They had nothing to do with medical facilities per se, and at that point Planned Parenthood sued. The government at last minute, yesterday, pulled out and did approve one clinic run by Planned Parenthood to stay in operation. And that's where it stands today. So we have out in Kansas, the legislature, they are doing backhanded tricks to try to just preferentially shut down a particular clinic. All right, what I'd like to do now is go to our Tannen Weekly, which is great. And then we have Barbara Jo coming up in a minute. All right, we ready there? Andrea? Andrea's running the board today. Good job, Andrea. Here we go. This is Cost of Bribery Hits Historic Low.
Cost of Bribery Hits Historic Low. Recession Blamed. Washington, D.C., special to the Tannen Weekly. Sources in Washington confirmed today that the cost of buying a congressman or senator dropped dramatically in the last quarter. According to the Government Bribery Oversight Commission, the KBBI, Koch Brothers Bribery Index, hit an all-time low of 29.48 at the close of business on July 1st. Political economists report that the cost of a single-issue vote in Congress fell sharply to $3,850 from $5,000 in the previous congressional session. As expected, the vote of a senior senator maintained a 25% premium over that of his junior colleague, while the vote of a committee chairman slid 3% to $7,500. The cost of buying a representative for an entire session held its ground, ranging from $175,000 for an influential leader of the majority party to less than $95,000 for a minority spokesperson. On hot-button social issues, the cost to buy a vote was unchanged, despite a substantial drop in the low-interest categories, such as education and environmental protection. Citing the slow economy, analysts predict that bribery prices will remain flat for the upcoming session of Congress.
The Tannen Weekly is distributed by WSLRLP, FM 96.5, a Pacifica affiliate.
And we want to thank Pete Tannen for giving us that audio every week. He comes up with some of those satirical things pulled from real news items for this show. And Pete Tannen is a local writer. He's won awards. He lives here in Sarasota. And TannenWeekly.com is his website if you'd like to get more information.
And now I'd like to introduce our first guest, and this is Barbara Jo, who has written a really very beautiful book called Triumph and Hope. This book is about the Peace Corps and her experience in Honduras. Barbara is a human rights activist and has been all her life, and we'd like to talk to you about this book. Now, as I understand, Steve met you in Washington.
Yes, he came by the Eastern Market near my house, and we chatted, and he asked me to appear on your program.
All right, Barbara, so I saw you sitting out there with some books stacked up and some information about the Peace Corps. Tell us a little bit about yourself. You did the Peace Corps your whole life, yes?
Well, I thought about it my whole life, practically. In 1961, when President Kennedy announced its formation, I would have liked to have gone, but I was newly married. We were buying a house. I had a new job. My husband was in graduate school. I just couldn't go then, and then later, children and a divorce, and actually the tragic death of my son, I just didn't go. And then it started percolating in my mind again, and at 62 I ended up going in the year 2000, and I ended up staying longer than the term, that the usual term is 27 months. I stayed almost 3.5 years, and partly I was spurred on by a friend my age who said, "Oh, this is ridiculous. The Peace Corps is only for young people. You'll be home by Christmas at the latest." And every time the going got a little rough, I thought of that, and I said, I can't give in to that. And I ended up actually extending my term, and I was there for 3 Christmases. So I showed him.
All right, so I've always wanted to join the Peace. Many of us have always sort of had that thought when we were teenagers and around high school age and college, thinking, "Oh, we'll join the Peace Corps." I didn't do it, but tell some. Why would you want to join? What was your idea before the Peace Corps, and then once you joined, how did that change?
Well, of course, when you join, you're a little bit more idealistic than when you're in the actual situation, I have to say, because everyday life intrudes. But in the end, I have to say that it was more life-changing, even at an older age, than I had ever expected. I developed friendships, really lifetime friendships. I go back every year with projects that I started in the Peace Corps. I go back the month of February. I've been back 7 times since I left. And it just really makes you, even at an older age, it changes you. Now, most Peace Corps volunteers are young people, because who can take 27 months out of their life and really work for almost nothing? They give you a subsistence allowance and a mustering out pay, but essentially you're not out there earning a living, or you're becoming educated, but not in a formal sense. However, the number of older people have always is growing, and they were always a factor. Miss Lillian, if you remember, President Carter's mother was a nurse in India in her late 60s. That was before he was even president. And probably 8% of volunteers now are over 50. In Honduras, we started, or I primarily, but it's still going strong, a support group for older people. It was called Oaks. We had an oak tree as our logo, and
what did the oak stand for?
Well, we made up the logo and the acronym first, and then we said, what could that stand for? And we decided Older and Knowing Souls. That was a little bit of imagination there. But anyway, every year I go back, and there are still Oaks people, and we would get together. We loved our younger counterparts. They accepted us totally, but once in a while we wanted to be together just with people who'd had similar life experience.
Barbara, I do have a question. What did you do? Just lock the door on your house and leave? Who watered your plants while you were gone in the Peace
Corps?
Well,
I do have a house that's 100 years old on Capitol Hill in Washington. I love my house. And I hated to leave it, but I ended up renting out my house. And I rented it furnished. I wouldn't advise people to do that.
So otherwise,
for a long time when you're gone to another country.
All right, Barbara, one of the things in your book that I thought was very interesting was you said how older people with more experience actually tend to be more reliable and do better in the Peace Corps than some of the younger people. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, in a traditional society, which all the Peace Corps countries are, the age is respected. Most of us had more skills at that point. You know, if you're 21 years old and you just got out of college, you don't have a lot of experience of how to organize things, and people in another country don't regard you as an authority. And I think in terms of emotional stability, the older people did better. Many younger people got homesick. They missed their boyfriend or girlfriend. They got depressed.
Did you feel you were treated better as an older person there than in this country?
Absolutely. I think, yes, we were almost revered. And one little aside, which I mentioned in my book, is, of course, because we're an American citizen, and I was single, I was divorced at that point. By the way, my last name, Joe, is from my late father-in-law, who was from Korea, but I kept it. Anyway, people say, Barbara Joe, what's your last name? That's it. But anyway, I had many marriage proposals from men of all ages, some of them married, some of them even teenagers, I guess, because they wanted to marry
an American
and come to the United States. But so that's kind of flattering, because here, who would ask me to marry them? Not many people.
What about the language?
The language. Well, that is often a stumbling block for older people. Fortunately, I already knew Spanish, but the older people in our group who had little or no Spanish, they really had to have extra tutoring. They really struggled with that. And the other problem that older people may have is health. Now, if you have a really chronic problem, if you have heart disease or cancer, you're probably not going to join the Peace Corps, and you're not going to be out in the boondocks. But the Peace Corps will adapt to other conditions. We had a woman in our Oak support group who had insulin-dependent diabetes, and she was placed in a locale that had electricity. She had a little refrigerator. Every week, the Peace Corps delivered in a styrofoam container her insulin to be injected. And also, they will adapt to physical disabilities depending on the needs of the country. I know a volunteer who is still blind, who was an English teacher in Morocco. I met one who is deaf, who taught American Sign, English Language Sign, in Kenya.
What did you do on a day-to-day basis? How did you interact with the people there?
All right. Well, of course, you have your daily living, which was a little bit more difficult than here, although, really, you adapt to that very quickly. And when you come back to this country, you have reverse culture shock. You think, do I need hot water? Do I need running water? Do I need air conditioning? I mean, it's nice to have it, but I always have more reverse culture shock. But adapting to that, yes, on a daily basis, it was a daily living chores were more arduous, if you will, or time-consuming. in the first town that I lived in, El Triunfo, the Triumph, which is the first part of my book title, we had latrines. We had a pila, which is a water basin where you would dip a bucket or a basin into it and pour water on yourself. That's how you bathe. We cooked over a wood stove, you know, gather wood and light a fire and cook.
What were some of your responsibilities there?
Well, of course, that's just the daily living. My responsibilities centered around a health center, a public health center in that town, where staff attended the patients, and I helped them. I went out on vaccination campaigns for the children. I went around in the rainy season to advise people to dump standing water so that malaria and dengue mosquitoes couldn't breed. By the way, I did get malaria myself once, even though we were taking a prophylactic against it. And did health education in the villages. I had some women that I trained in the villages, and they're still working even though I'm not there, and I go back every year and give them a little boost. HIV education was a big part of our task because Honduras has a high rate of HIV. Also, child survival, children under five, they die mainly from respiratory and intestinal infections, how to treat those, nutrition, safe birthing. We did a training of midwives. So I would, I mostly worked with women, occasionally men, especially on environmental problems. I had a site mate, a young man who was one of those who left early, and he was a water and sanitation specialist, and then I took over his duties and had certain wells of clean water installed in a couple of villages. And so it was kind of eclectic what you do.
Tell us a little bit about the hope part. Your book is Triumph and Hope.
Hope was the second town that I, when I extended my time after the 27 months, the El Triunfo, the first town, was in a very, very hot climate, and it was often over 100 degrees. And if you're out hitchhiking, as I did, riding horseback, bicycle, walking, I'm in my 60s, I said, you know, I don't think I can take this climate anymore. I'd like to stay in this country, but I'd like a different climate. So then I was assigned to La Esperanza, the Hope, which was about 6,000 feet, a completely different climate. It can be chilly, actually.
The air is thin. Could you breathe?
Could you what?
Could you breathe?
Oh, yes, you can breathe, but you maybe get a little out of breath hiking around. But when I go back for a medical brigade, it's always in that area, and it gets cold at night, not freezing, but there's no heat, of course, in the houses. In Honduras, people have a very small carbon footprint, and I kind of have that here in Washington now. I don't turn on air conditioning unless I need it. I don't have a car. I don't have TV. I try to live simply.
Yeah, it sounds like this experience have changed you. We're listening to the voice of Barbara Jo. She won a award-winning book, Triumph and Hope, which was the best nonfiction finalist in the National Indie Excellence Award. It's called Triumph and Hope, which you published this yourself, right? We're not going to get this on the commercial bookstores, is that correct?
No, you can get it on Amazon.com.
Okay.
It's also on Kindle. And may I say, another award, which I'm even more proud of, is from Peace Corps Writers, 2009 Best Peace Corps Memoir of 2009. So, on Amazon, bookstores can get it, but they have to get it through a distributor. I think it's just easier to get it on Amazon.
There's a few different ways that this book sort of touched me, Barbara, and I spoke with you about it. One of the ways is just your writing style, which I love, is that you have these personal stories and stories for yourself and people that you've met, which just are heart-wrenching, good and bad things that have happened to people. And then you'll throw in some statistics about the amount of hunger or the poverty in Honduras and other nations around the world and the need for help. And I just want to comment. I just love your writing style, that I can get this personal story and then I can get this factual information in a seamless way. I just haven't seen in other books like that.
It's like effortless learning.
It's effortless. Yeah. So let me ask you this question. So you said that this experience has changed you, and I want you to share with us about some of the culture's taboos and things that you discovered in Honduras and in these communities, and share with us some personal stories. Let's start with some things you don't want to say in Honduras.
Well, you wouldn't want to say you were gay if you were, for sure. And some of the volunteers were, and they just could not reveal that. Now, I don't know if that's changing there as it is in this country, but certainly it was sufficiently dangerous in a remote area to do that, so they didn't. Being Jewish was not kosher, and we had I knew a Jewish man married to a Christian woman, and a Catholic she was, which is the majority in Honduras. He went to mass with her. He never said that he was Jewish. So there were certain things like that. Now, one other cultural thing that we were not accustomed to in this country, I'm sure there's infidelity in marriage, but in Honduras, the men, it's very open. Many of them have, it's very common that they would have more than one woman. Maybe a wife that they married, and then another woman with whom they have a household with children. They go back and forth between them. The first wife may resent it, but she accepts it because it's kind of a cultural norm. So that was shocking, especially to some of our younger volunteers. They said, well, he just openly goes to this other woman's house that has children with her, and nobody says boo. Of course, a woman would never be in that position. It's strictly men.
And let's say a Peace Corps member went over and, let's say, violated a taboo by either admitting that they were gay or that they were Jewish, okay, or whatever. Do you have any stories about how the local culture would react to those types of revelations?
Well, I think being Jewish is not quite as severe as being gay. Being Jewish is more severe when you're right around Easter and, you know, the crucifixion and all that supposedly blamed on the Jews. Being gay, they never revealed it. I can't tell you an instance where that happened, and I think if it had, it just may have meant that the person would have to leave, or they would have to leave that area. I will tell you about an instance, though, of and maybe because of the recent hearings in Congress about rape and even killing of volunteers. First of all, I would recommend that any young woman from the U.S. should live with other people in another country, because the young women who are indigenous to that country, never single women, don't live by themselves. So I think that some American young women don't realize that, and that's been part of the danger. Not that I'm blaming them for what happened, but we had a woman in Honduras, a volunteer, who was part of a gang rape situation. In Honduras, when crimes occur, almost never, even when people know the perpetrator, they don't denounce them. They think the police are not going to do anything, and they'll get the repercussions against themselves if they do.
Is that true? Do the police usually not do anything?
Well, the police are spread very thin, very poorly paid, very poorly educated. They don't have resources. And they're, and they could be easily corrupted. And they probably couldn't protect you if you denounce somebody for committing a crime. That person could hurt or kill you, you know, for doing that, and that seems to be the greater danger. But in this case, three women were raped by this group, and the other one, everyone knew who they were. Only the American volunteer identified him, but with the help of the U.S. Embassy, they went to court, they convicted them, and then she stayed in Honduras, but she moved to another locality, so where she wasn't known, and she, of course, wouldn't have revealed that had happened to her.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's say you're just arriving there and you have your boot camp, which we want to ask you about, and the initial training, and then also just mention about the brigades, because you have different people with different backgrounds assigned different tasks.
Now, you're talking about, okay, when we come into Honduras, before we go into Honduras, may I say, when you apply to the Peace Corps, it takes about a year to get through the whole application process, the FBI check and your background and medical, dental references and so forth. So be prepared for, but before you join, usually, now not everyone, some people say, I'll go anywhere in the world, I'm up for adventure. Others pick an area of the world, and the areas that are available are Latin America, Caribbean, Eastern Europe, Africa, North Africa, the Middle Eastern countries, Asia, including China, believe it or not, and Pacific Islands. So you would pick an area, but you should never specify a country, because the Peace Corps seems to be very averse to that. They want to put you in an area. Well, anyway, I asked for Latin America, because I already knew Spanish. And by the way, now I work as a Spanish interpreter. That's one thing that changed in my life since I was in the Peace Corps. I never thought.
And Barbara, I just want to tell you, we're just about coming out to the end of our segment, so we're running out of time here.
Okay, I'm sorry. The question was, what do we do when we get there? We've already picked not only the area where we're going to work, but also not only the region, but the area we want to work in. In Honduras, I asked for health because that was my background, but there were other agriculture, there was water and sanitation, youth development, and it depends on the country what areas you work in. So then we're trained in language, in my case I already knew it, in culture, I already knew it, but also in our area of, that we're going to be working.
All right, so your book is Triumph and Hope, written by Barbara Joe. Joe is the last name. And you're welcome to tell people either if you have a website or where they can go and get your book.
Yes, all right. They can get the book on Amazon.com, and they can communicate with me via my blog, which has my email address on it, and it's http://. Honduras Peace Corps, that's all one word, and Corps has an S on the end of it, .blogspot.com. So I'd be happy to hear from anyone who's heard this broadcast, and if, especially if you're an older person interested in the Peace Corps, I advocate for that.
Thank you so much, Barbara Jo. We look forward to hearing more from you.
All right. Thanks.
All right, comments. I have a Media Matters Minute, and we have Pete Gross going to be calling in just a second. Any comments before we go to Media Matters?
Yeah, you know, I thought that was so interesting. She had a lot of hardship and loss in her life, and as she aged, she kind of distributed the love she had for her nuclear family to the world. And I guess, you know, when I read the book, that's the message that I took away, that, you know, that people in the latter part of their lives can go out into the world and, you know, they just have so much to offer and so much more credibility in many cases than, you know, kids, younger people.
I think that's a good point. And I think, yes, that love doesn't just disappear as the family grows up and goes away. And I think this is a problem for a lot of older people is, what do I do with all this feeling and all this human experience that I have now that it seems as if nobody needs me? And the Peace Corps is a great thing. And, of course, there are things at home if you don't want to go get malaria.
I found her very inspiring, especially that for older people can have an opportunity too, because I felt like sort of I missed my chance for the Peace Corps. Yeah, maybe there's another chance here.
And I loved when she said she came back to the States and she had the inverse, you know, reaction. No TV, cutting back on air conditioning.
Yes.
I mean, that's really interesting.
Reverse culture shock. I thought very interesting.
And do I really need hot water? Doesn't cold water work just fine?
Yeah, if we thought more like that on a daily basis, we'd all, you know, be...
Well, our next guest is going to tell us a little bit about energy and maybe about conservation, and that's Peter Gross. And you're listening to WSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, Surreal News Show. My name is Steve. Our other co-hosts here are Andrea and Joan in the studio.
Yes, and we'd like to welcome Peter Gross. Peter is a nuclear reactor physicist who is now living in the area and who is very active and hands across the sand. And this is a group, a national environmentalist group that's interested in protecting our Gulf of Mexico. This group is endorsed by many national environmental organizations, including Transition Sarasota, the Sierra Club, the Otterburn Surf Founder Foundation, Oceana, Defenders of Wildlife, and the list goes on and on. Welcome, Pete.
Hi, Pete. So, good morning.
Good morning.
I understand you've already been taking care of turtles. So I met you at the Hands Across the Sand event. This was the one in Bradenton last week. Tell me, how does someone go from being a nuclear physicist to standing on the shore holding hands about oil?
Oh, it's a symbol. The word is retirement.
And commitment.
Some of that, too.
So, so tell us about... What is it about this organization, or what is it about this, about offshore drilling, that that gets you to get up and get out, besides from being retired? I'm sure you have other things to do as well. But what is it about this issue that you feel compassionate about?
Well, I think, as all of you know, after the Deepwater Horizon last year, that raised everybody's consciousness about the concerns of oil on our beaches, in our aquaculture, in the environment. And when I saw that they were holding another event this year, it seemed to me that that's something I should try to get going on our island, Anna Maria Island. And I noticed they had nothing on Longboat Key. They had one group planning to get together on Saturday, the 25th of June, further north on the island, but nowhere where I live. So I put the word out that we'll hold an event here at noon, Saturday the 25th, to become part of this worldwide activity that's telling people stop doing offshore drilling and begin replacing coal and oil with clean energy. And that's really the objective. And what we did Saturday worldwide on all the beaches, cities around the world, is at 12 noon local time, we got people to stand up and join hands and make a line in the sand, essentially saying, enough already, stop the drilling and begin focusing on use of clean energy. And it's critical to our future and the future of the planet.
And I say, to some degree, part of the motivation behind this is try to get things out in the news, or trying to get the word out, correct?
Absolutely.
And tell us, I don't know, did you see, well, my picture was in the paper, apparently. People told me I didn't see it. But apparently it did make the papers, yes?
Made several local papers. It made the Bradenton paper. We were on Bay News 9 television. Just the one event at our beach, and there were roughly 40 people there.
Now, you know, this demonstration this year, as opposed to last year, you know, which there were a greater number of people coming out, sort of concerned me, because I think people are getting a little complacent about the Gulf. You know, now that BP has settled down a little bit, they think that, you know, we don't have to still protect it and think about it. But we are still very threatened by offshore drilling. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. In fact, if you look at the Exxon Valdez, that is now 22 years old, and they are still finding oil on the beaches up in Alaska from that event. Here it's barely a year, and they're still finding oil on the beaches here. And there'll be oil in the environment and on our beaches for a long time to come up in the Panhandle area. And if you think about it, there have been a number of reports from surveys done by local universities saying there's a large volume of oil still on the bottom of the Gulf, and it's so far down, it's so cold, the microbes are not effectively degrading it. So that's going to be there in the environment for a very long time. And nobody knows for sure right now what impact that will have on the aquaculture, the local fishing conditions, and so forth, because it appears that the microbes can't degrade it, and it could be impacting the bottom of the food chain right in that part of the Gulf, and we won't know that for maybe a decade or two to come.
All right, so here at WSLR, occasionally we take our submarine down, our WSLR submarine down, and look around. We're certainly probably due to do that. Last time we did that was for the red tide, when we went down and looked around on the air. That's interesting. The other way of looking at this issue, besides from what's going on with the oil actually in the Gulf, is the policies by our government which set up the situations that we're in. For example, offshore leases. And do you want to comment on the current administration and their issuing of new offshore leases with the current technology?
Well, that's clearly a concern. It was obvious at the time that we understated throughout the event how much oil had spilled. We had very little understanding of what the impact of the dispersants were. In fact, we know at this time the dispersants could have caused more damage than the oil itself if we had just left it alone. The fact that we're doing more leases, possibly deeper wells, possibly closer to shore, spells nothing but issues going forward. And I think a more ironic issue to me is the very day, June 25th, that we had this global hands across the sand event in the state of Florida, the Senate president and the governor both made a statement that they're trying to call for a new state energy policy that will actually open the door to drill for oil and gas on Florida's coast, much closer to the coast than the deepwater horizon is. So that does not bode well for our future.
We reported on this show that those leases are approved for the technology which is virtually identical to those in the Horizon disaster, and that virtually none or very minimal window dressing only regulations or changes have been made. Comment on that and the possibility of a repeating of this disaster?
I'm guessing even if we don't do any additional drilling, it's not a question of possibility, it's a probability, it's a question of when it happens. There are so many wells out there already. Some are seeping, accidents happen. We're certainly no better equipped now than we were before. We have one data point that will not cover all possible cases for future events. So if you think about it, we are vulnerable, and the vulnerability is only increasing as we add more wells.
I was wondering what you see as the more promising sources of clean energy.
Well, clearly, if we look at what we're giving the oil companies back in the way of subsidies, something like $4 billion annually, what if we had put that money into clean energy research and development for the last 10 or 15 years? That would have probably resulted in lots of new technologies, lots of new enhancements to what we already have in the areas of solar, tidal, wind, things like that. And instead, we're just providing money from our taxes to the wealthiest companies on the earth that just increase their profits. Does nothing to improve the situation here on the planet. Does nothing to get us further along with clean energy research, storage of energy, battery technology, things like that. And I'm guessing there could well be new energy sources or approaches that we don't even know about yet, because we haven't put the energy and the money into thinking about how we can start solving these critical problems.
The arguments I hear from people that I run into are the workers on the oil rigs who fear being put out of a job. Are there ways that they could be employed in other places?
How is that any different than the millions of people who have been unemployed for the last 2 to 3 years? If you think about employment, as a matter of fact, just looking at the state of Florida, tourism constitutes about $65 billion of Florida's economy. That's about 12% of our total economy. That is the single greatest source of income to the state. We're employing over 1 million people in our beach communities, inland, in Orlando, places like that, based on tourism. Now, if our beaches are covered with oil, a good fraction of that, possibly up to half of those people, will not be coming back here. So talk about employment issues. It's not just the workers on the wells. It's everybody else that's involved in industries that could be impacted by these events.
That's true, and this is a very precarious industry because, you know, after BP, even though we weren't seeing, you know, oil on our beaches down here, you know, in Southwest Florida, our tourism dropped significantly just on, you know, rumor and innuendo. So it is a highly sensitive, you know, industry, I guess is what I'm saying, and any prospect.
It's very susceptible not even to the reality of oil, but just the concern of oil.
Right.
Well, and the fishing industry suffered as well.
All right, so some of the other things that come here are turtles, and that's one of the things that you're involved with. Also, emergency management, community response team. Talk to us about when I spoke to you last week, you were involved with some turtle protection, and also on Anna Maria Island, there was those blackbirds a little bit further up on the island, which I saw, which are very interesting to take a look at. So tell us about some of the ecological things, just sort of switching gears for a minute to some of the other hats that you wear.
Sure. One of the things my wife and I are both involved in is the Anna Maria Island Turtle Watch. We've been involved in that ever since we moved down here. And the way our beach is set up, we have 9 miles of beach, about a mile each section is assigned to a team, and the team has a person out checking that section of beach every morning about 30 minutes before sunrise, looking for evidence of new turtles having laid nests or existing nests having hatched. And we're right in the middle of the turtle season right now, and clearly if we had oil on the beaches, that would destroy the population of turtles that keep coming back to these beaches year after year after year, for literally millions of years. Now, once the turtles leave a beach and don't come back after a while, they will never populate that beach with new nests again. Once the local group, the nests on those beaches are destroyed, that's the end of those beaches as nesting habitats. So that's a very great concern, and clearly we have to keep a look at what's happening up in the Panhandle area based on last year's activities. Luckily, they took the hatchlings after the Deepwater Horizon, and they released them on the East Coast where it was safe to release them, because had they released them in the Gulf and let them do what they normally do, we probably would have lost that whole group of this last year's set of hatchlings.
And then just tell our listeners, there were some birds that are also what the birds are doing there. But
in addition to the turtles, the Anna Maria Island Turtle Watch also deals with nesting and protection of bird species along the beach, our shorebirds. We currently have one of the larger colonies of black skimmers, which I believe are the birds you're referring to, that are nesting in the northern part of the island. We have about 250 of the skimmers nesting there at the current time. The chicks actually started hatching about a week and a half ago, so we started seeing chicks, and there's probably 3 or 4 dozen of them out there at the current time. We're keeping a close watch on them. We've got them behind a protected enclosure. The big concern is this coming weekend with the fireworks and the celebrations. If they're disturbed and leave the area, those chicks and those eggs will never live. So we're going to do our best to try to keep people aware of the concerns there and make sure they keep the celebrations away from the nesting habitat.
We're listening to the voice of Pete Gross, who lives in the Bradenton area, who's involved with the Hand Across the Sand and some other things. And just briefly, spend about just a few seconds, we're just about to the end of time here, about your emergency response team.
Yes, that's something we got started on the island last year, the Community Emergency Response Team. These are cropping up all over the nation. And what they are teams of local people, volunteers, who are trained to deal with crises and emergencies and disasters especially. So in our case, the residents of Anna Maria Island are being trained to deal with disasters such as hurricanes. And among the things we try to do is educate the local people. Should a hurricane hit our island after everybody evacuates, we'll be among the first people back to assist with getting the island rehabitable again, getting people back, and performing any necessary emergency services in coordination with the normal emergency services professionals.
All right, and tell our listeners if they want to get some more information about Hands Across the Sand or the things that you're doing, some websites or resources for us.
Yeah, there are some excellent websites. In fact, you can look at Anna Maria Island Turtle Watch, do a Google search on that, and you'll find out all about what we're doing there with turtles and birds. For Hands Across the Sand, again, a Google search on Hands Across the Sand. And if you look, if you wanted to find out more about the Community Emergency Response Team, you could just drop me an email. It's very simple, amicert@gmail.com, and we'll get back to you if you have any interest in contributing to us. We're a nonprofit. Or more important, if you're a full-time resident on Anna Maria Island, we'd love to have you come join us.
Fabulous. Thank you, Peter. Pleasure speaking with you, and we look forward to hearing some more about your work.
Thank you.
And have a great day. All right, well, we have lots more news. We have disclaimers and things to read. I got Media Matters Minutes to do. I'd love to at least get to one of these guys. So let's at least do one Media Matters Minute because we've had such a packed show, and then we're going to wrap it up.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Danny Herrera. Over the weekend, First Lady Michelle Obama was asked by a CNN reporter how the First Family is preparing for another presidential campaign. Her answer was twisted by several conservative blogs who argued that Mrs. Obama confessed to a supposed liberal bias in the media. But take a closer listen to the audio.
When you go back home, you're going to walk into also a pretty dangerous environment, a political presidential campaign, a new presidential campaign. How's the family ready for this?
Fortunately, we have help from the media. And I have to say this, is that I'm very grateful for the support and kindness that we've gotten. People have respected their privacy. And in that way, I think, you know, no matter what people may feel about my husband's policies or what have you, they care about children. And that's been good.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm Jess Levin. Fox News host Sean Hannity took to the radio airwaves to brag about the access he has to Republican presidential candidates.
You know, it's funny to me. Because every Republican presidential candidate we have interviewed either the day they announce or the day after they announce.
That is funny, Sean. Maybe it has something to do with the kid glove treatment they get on your show. Here he is with Michelle Bachman.
John Wayne was born in Iowa. You obviously misspoke. The media's kind of made a big deal about it. I wanted to give you a chance. You think there's a double standard. I think you said Waterloo. And they say, well, wait a minute, John Wayne Gacy was born there. And the media made a big deal of that. I wanted to get you to respond, but through this prism. I put together some of the mistakes that President Obama has made, and I want to just remind people of some of the things he said over the years.
For this story and more, visit MediaMatters.org.
This is the Media Matters.
All right, that was our Media Matters Minute, and we want to thank Media Matters for supplying us with that audio, nonprofit organization out of Washington, D.C., a conservative misinformation watchdog. Thanks for tuning in to the Surreal News.
And this hour of Surreal News has been brought to you by NewView, a local company specializing in managing your home and window washing and cleaning. From property management to house cleaning is what they do. NewView has served Sarasota residents for 15 years. You can reach them on the internet at newview.inc.
And I want to remind our listeners that the views you hear here are not those of WSLR, its board members or volunteers or anyone else, just those of the people that gave them. Take what you like and leave the rest. Today it's going to be about 89 with about a 50 to 60% chance of rain, and it's going to be less over the weekend. This is the July 4th weekend coming up. A lot of celebrations going on.
Be careful with your fireworks because it's very dry out there.
And you, Andrea, you have a new guest you're going to line up for next week, you think?
Yeah, next week we're going to have visiting with us Dr. Beach, a.k.a. Stephen Leatherman, and he's going to talk to us about how he rates beaches in Florida. Apparently, he's just rated Sarasota's Siesta Key Beach number one, and that has gone through the roof in terms of our tourism. We're way up on that rating, and it's pretty fantastic, so we're going to ask him how he does it, why he does it.
Very good. Thanks for tuning in to WLSLR 96.5 LPFM in Sarasota, Florida, your community radio station. Stay tuned for Complex Waveforms, which is coming up right now.